Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So we're getting on in the retreat past the middle point, and I've had some time to just settle into it, get used to the schedule. Body should be getting used to always sitting, and the mind accustoming itself to the place. Chance to let some of the coarser energies of the world fade. And I talked yesterday a little bit about the nature of the preliminaries which we need to cultivate in order for it to issue very naturally in more and more refined states, more and more serenity, a little more energy, power. You may find yourself that your depleted batteries from the world are starting to recharge, and also a little more focus and awareness on the contents of the mind. And I hope that the sense of context too, that you're beginning to just see feelings as feelings, not as my feeling in a storyline around me, in a personal history, and that you're beginning to see thoughts just as thoughts, a little more impersonally. It's like watching clouds come and go, not personalizing it. Not a variety of thoughts in a storyline about a character called me. Beginning to regard the body again, once again, asking yourself, whose is this? Where did it come from? What's my relationship to it? Who does it belong to? If it's mine, how did I make it? Do I control it? Do I have much say over it? Perhaps I should restore it to its original owner, back to nature. Reminding ourselves of the real nature of the body, what it looks like inside, what it's made of. Forgetting the fictional overlays that are commonplace in the way we talk about our bodies and talk about other bodies. Getting back to the bare bones truth, try to take off the screens of perception that are overlaid onto our minds that we rarely undo and start at the beginning again. And that is the that is how truth is discovered, isn't it? The nature of really important inquiry into things is to start all over again, not to take things for granted. So meditation and meditation retreats are for this purpose, just to go back to the basic building blocks, not to take things for granted. That is the brilliance and the simplicity of the Buddha's teachings. He's just instructing to see the body in the body, know it just as body. Not as my body, just as body. See the feelings in the feelings. Not my feelings, just feelings. Rising and passing away. Also that kind of over obvious fact that he's pointing to. It's so plain, so obvious to us. Somehow it escapes our attention. That the quality, the really comprehensive truth of the matter of the body and the feelings and the thought processes is that they're rising, passing away. Who could they be if they're rising and passing away? Whose could they be if they're rising and passing away? They disappear. They rise out of conditions. They're not substantial, evanescent, and disappearing. We don't want to lay claims or ownership over them. We don't want to make a preoccupied story, melodrama around these rising, passing phenomena created out of nature, that we have only the dimmest notion of how these conditions come to be and how they pass away. And yet we are so involved in them, grasping at them very tightly. So that little summary is basically what the notion of the four foundations of mindfulness is all about. Again, not just mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness and concentration. And not just mindfulness and concentration, but also mindfulness, concentration, and clear comprehension of what we're about, what is suitable at the time, what I should be doing as I cross the gymnasium, what I should be doing as I step out into the air out there, as one goes to the cafeteria, as one goes back to one's room. Clearly comprehending, understanding what's suitable, directing the mind, being attentive, reflecting on what's appropriate in terms of a suitable object at this particular time, noting what's in the mind, if aversion comes up, if distraction comes up, if preoccupation comes up, then to note it and then ask yourself, what would be the appropriate and wise response? Where is this coming from? How far did I get lost in this before I even noticed it? I should pay more attention to the beginning of things. And questions like, am I personalizing this? Once again, reminding oneself. And one of the other synonym for mindfulness is reminding. It is one of the qualities, one of the definitions of mindfulness is the capacity to remind yourself again, one more time. Wait a sec, there's nothing personal here. Don't take it personally. Letting go of the drama, the person in the story. So these lay the foundations. They are foundations, in a sense, for the practice. We sometimes call this the four foundations of mindfulness. They're foundational practices, but they're also foundations for resting the attention on the body, the feelings, mental processes, and dhammic categories, or foundations as in a building is resting on foundations. So the place to anchor the mind. You could also think of it in terms of anchors for the mind. It gives your mind a place to go. All of this, of course, is moving and coalescing. We're trying to bring up the factors of enlightenment. So when this starts to integrate, starts to gel, one should be noting the either the arising of the factors of enlightenment in some form or another, or if the absence of them, to then very deliberately turn towards the cultivation of this and try to bring them up. Remember that meditation is not necessarily a passive thing that happens to you. You are actively striving with vital interest in the matter. That should be some words that play in your mind. This is a matter of vital interest to me, my own happiness, my own well-being. I'm not just waiting for it to appear. I am actually infusing this, contributing to the energy that brings this about skillfully, involved in a project here. The art and craft of cultivation of the seven factors of enlightenment. So today I'd like to just talk about these factors of enlightenment. I'll give you as well a brief reading of the Buddha's description of these factors. Once again, the factors are, and when you listen to talks like this, you don't have to be too concerned to absorb every bit of information in the talk. Dhammic listening, there's the art of Dhamma talking and there's the art of Dhamma listening. And Dhamma listening is really just being serene, opening the mind to it. You won't be tested afterwards on this. It's not one of those tedious kind of situations like at university where it's a matter of getting the information. It's a matter of opening the mind to whatever is important to the mind, whatever the mind needs, it will find in the flow of words, in the flow of tone. So one just listens openly. And maybe only one phrase will be taken away from a talk. But that phrase will be very important. It'll be a theme. It'll be something the mind needs now and can use now. It's important in whatever stage of the project you're in. That's what you need. So don't be over concerned to understand everything at once or to retain everything either. It's again a very different kind of listening. And have to trust that at certain level, below the conscious discursive level, the mind is waiting to hear certain things that will be of use to it. So if it sounds like a lot of information, seven this, five that, four this, don't worry. The mind will process it just as is appropriate to its nature. Seven factors are, once again, mindfulness, the investigation of Dhamma, energy. This word energy is sometimes translated as persistence. That's a translation by Ajahn Tanissaro. I don't know whether that really summarizes what we're talking about here. Sometimes we would call it effort. But I would say that it's a matter of being energetically persistent in a practice. Making effort, generating the energy which is required for doing work. This energy, once you start generating it, feeds on itself. There's a little back loop, a reinforcing loop. It's a mystery to when you're feeling tired or out of energy, you think, how do I get energy? And the answer is almost too obvious. If you look back over your experience, how you ever got energy was that you became energetic. A little bit of energy starts the fire going. So sometimes if you begin a work, not the work itself may seem to be overwhelming, but you just start a little bit, and that start produces fuel for continuation and increase of energy. So you find the more energy you put into something, the more energy you get back out of it. So it's a cycle of energy. In the same way, this attempt one more time to be mindful and to investigate requires the production of energy. And as you produce this energy, you start to get energy. You may have noticed in the retreat that you need less sleep as the retreat goes on. As you get involved in the project, quite often it satisfies you. And the energy just comes up. And we have enormous possibilities of energy. We just have to tap into them properly. After this energy, and intrinsically linked to it, is joyful quality. The joy comes up in the mind, but the mind is really pervades the body, and so the body can't be left out of the experience of the joy. It also has joy. Once again, these are the active sides of these seven factors. They're divided. The first four factors are active, more on the side of energy, and the last three are on the side of tranquility, serenity. So this energy, once it's been roused and becomes joyful, then cascades into serenity. It's like a little waterfall dropping into a pond. The pond itself, if you looked at ponds, and it, like the waterfall, the little fountain out there, the energy in the water is the one part that's being shot up into the air, and then it strikes the pond and dissolves into this more serene kind of body. But it also energizes that body. It brings oxygen to it, keeps it alive, and purifies it. So the same kind of thing, that cascade of energy and joy falls into the structure of serenity or tranquility. Maybe tranquility would be the better word. So that the energy remains orderly. If you get an excess of energy, it becomes disorderly or chaotic, and you get feedback loops, make it chaotic. So when the energy is streamed in the right way, into joy, channeled into joy properly, joy just naturally reaches a certain condition and then transforms itself into certain satisfaction or reflection or reflexive quality on the nature of joy. You become aware of the joy itself, and the awareness of the joy itself tends to be produce a sense of tranquility and contentment. This is not really super normal or anything more than the normal processes. If you look at your activities where you go, you watch a game or participate in a game or participate in listening to music, etc., there is the energy is aroused, the anticipation to become initiated into the process, and then it turns into enthusiasm and absorption and energy. And then when the moment the music resolves or ends, or the game resolves or ends, all of that energy and joyfulness, there's a quality of satisfaction that comes out of it. And that point is the point where the event turns from the active energetic side into its resultants, which are very pleasant, profitable resultants. Now that the mind is satisfied and entering tranquility, it is now in a perfect condition to focus and become still. More or less, you've satisfied the stronger, active, energetic part of the mind by these preliminaries, and now they lead naturally into this one-pointed focus, concentration, the notion of jhana, absorption, or if not jhana, something close to it, right on the edge of it. You may in fact waver in and out depending on your how much preliminary work you've done. And at the end of this concentration, which may go all the way from just basically on the edge of it, in the neighborhood of it, all the way to profound, place you've never been before, that you never knew was there, a marvelous discovery, a life-changing discovery of possibilities. What can happen when the mind really becomes still? Another dimension of being is uncovered. Rare? Ordinary person who doesn't meditate, it's very unlikely that they will ever experience it in their life. The person who does meditate, but only occasionally, without system, without instruction, it's unlikely that they will experience this unless they have a profound pool of talent that they're drawing from, and they might spontaneously experience this. You'd be an unusual character if that were the case. But it is not unlikely that if a person who practices meditation a lot, understands path, has simplified their life, directs their energies, has laid down the preliminaries, it's entirely possible that they can experience these deeper states of focus. But again, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We don't want to jump towards them or increase the frustration of our existence. Remember, these are not the active side. This is a resultant. Concentration is a resultant of having done preliminary work, of skillfully structured the active, energetic preliminaries to it. And this is what spills over and results from it. So learn to think in that way. Otherwise, you will be trying to do two things that are slightly incompatible at once. You'll be trying to raise the energy and effort to be concentrated, when really it's a preliminary. Energy is sustained in concentration, usually effortlessly, because it's so invigorating, it's so wonderful, that it has a little feedback loop in it itself. It inspires you to continue it. But so you may have been unskillfully focusing in the wrong way, trying to demand concentration out of yourself. When it's not but done that way, it is done a long ways back, several steps back, you take the run towards this, and this naturally results. That is, the concentration is the glide mode. And the other factors are the preliminaries. This is being hauled up, like in a glider, they have to haul you up first with another plane or haul you up on a cable. That has to be done first, but concentration is when I don't know if you've ever been up in a glider or you've seen this. At one point, you let the cable go. And then you're in glide mode. The original energy and pull and force, all has been arranged. And then at that point, the glide mode comes in. And that concentration is the resultant. That's why we can't just... Why doesn't just everybody sit down, listen to the instructions, and concentrate? Enter absorption. Can't. Nature doesn't work that way. Your glider is sitting on the ground, and you're tensing your fists or something to make this thing glide. Glide, glide. It has not been hauled up into the air yet. So the activity, energy, the preliminaries have to be put into place. Then it glides quite naturally. Of course, there's a moment of fear in that too. Many people report this. They come to a kind of an edge of something, and then there's a kind of a fear, a holding back. And this is exactly the moment when you release the cable. You think, under the thing that's pulling me up, the thing that's keep... Actually, it's the organization of the self. The thinking of the self that you're going to have to let go of in concentration. You have to stop thinking. Stop constructing yourself. You know, and that requires faith and kind of confidence and relaxation, letting go. We're a little bit apprehensive, nervous about this. In the same way that when at the moment they let that cable go off the bottom of the glider, it suddenly reduces in terms of its velocity and settles. There's a moment there when you think, I wonder if it's going to stay up this time. But there's, you become confident in that. You realize that the system works. So it is coming to the edge of that, but you have to let go. You have to disconnect that effort, energy, organizational pattern and let it have its resultant into absorption. When the concentration has reached its limits in the deepest levels of absorption, this quality of equanimity arises, where it's beyond what we would call pleasure or pain. It's even beyond what we call joy or happiness. It's a finer energy than that, more refined, superior experience to that. It's so balanced, so clear, so refined. There are different types of equanimity. There's equanimity which has to do with wisdom, assessing a situation, checks and balances, keeping oneself balanced in the midst of change. And there's equanimity that comes out of a profound stillness of the mind. The seventh factor of enlightenment, which is equanimity, could be either of these or both of these, since it follows the idea of absorption or concentration. It could be what happens in the deepest level of concentration as a kind of absolute stillness. Or it can be looking back reflectively over the process that you've gone through, understanding what happened there. You roused mindfulness. The preliminaries were put in. You had tidied up what you had to do in life. You've tidied up the mind. You feel clear. You've directed the attention towards investigation of Dhamma. Energy arose because of the process. This resulted in joy, which cascaded over into serenity and then down into focus. And the focus went stiller and stiller into a state of profound stillness, which we call equanimity. And then one is looking back over the experience from that vantage point of total stillness, when something is balanced perfectly. Sometimes give the analogy of trying to balance a broomstick in your palm of your hand. When you practice this, eventually the wavering and movement of it can actually come to an absolute still point. So this is the kind of process. This is what the Buddha now is extracting this out of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. All of these factors could be found in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, but he's extracting a certain sequence. Which need to be emphasized at a certain point in the development of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Emphasized and extracted from that, and then you pay attention to that. I'll read a little bit of the, just the description of this, of seven factors of enlightenment, so we can consider that. And I gave a talk, of course, about this, the development, and I've tried to sort of frame the whole retreat in terms of developing towards these seven factors, but here's a paragraph just to remind you. On cognizing an unpleasant idea with the intellect, one is not upset, one's mind is not unsettled, one's feelings are not wounded, one's mind does not become resentful. Unmoved in body and unmoved in mind, one is inwardly well composed and well released. This is how restraint of the senses, when developed and pursued, lead to the culmination of the three courses of right conduct. And how are the three courses of right conduct developed and pursued so as to lead to the culmination of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness? There is the case when one abandons wrong conduct in terms of deeds, in terms of speech, in terms of thought, and develops right conduct in terms of speech, deed, and thought. This is how the three courses of right conduct, when developed and pursued, lead to the culmination of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And how are the four foundations of mindfulness developed and pursued so that the seven factors of awakening come to completion? On whatever occasion, one remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside covetousness and greed for the world, covetousness and grief for the world. On that occasion, one's mindfulness is steady and without lapse. When mindfulness is steady and without lapse, then mindfulness as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. Remaining mindful in this way, one examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment. When one remains mindful in this way, examining, analyzing, coming to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, then investigation of Dhamma, or analysis of qualities, as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. And one who examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, unflagging energy is aroused. When unflagging energy is aroused in one who examines, analyzes, and comes to a comprehension of that quality with discernment, then this energy as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. In one whose energy is aroused, a rapture not of the flesh arises. When joy not of the flesh arises in one whose persistence is aroused, then rapture as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. For one who is enraptured, who has joy, the body grows calm and the mind grows calm. When the body and mind of an enraptured person grows calm, then serenity as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for him, for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. For one who is at ease, whose body is calmed, the mind becomes concentrated. When the mind of one who is at ease, whose body is calmed, becomes concentrated, then concentration as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them it goes to the culmination of its development. One oversees the mind thus concentrated with equanimity. When one oversees the mind thus concentrated with equanimity, equanimity as a factor of awakening becomes aroused. One develops it, and for them, it goes to the culmination of its development. And this process is similar for feelings, mind, and mental qualities. So you remember that this is initially based on the body. The seven factors arose based on mindfulness of the body, investigation of the body. The seven factors can be aroused on mindfulness of the feelings, investigation of the feelings, and then energy, joy, serenity, concentration, equanimity. So any of the four foundations or resting or anchors of mindfulness can be used to develop these factors. And that's what we're aiming for. It's the development and culmination. All these factors have to be, one of the critical elements in this is that they have to be balanced. They flow in a sequence, one proceeding from the other, but they also all remain, they don't disappear. So the Buddha has a various similes of the sort of a growth development. Of one factor leading out of the other, but also he has a simile of the rafters of a roof, that all seven factors are like the rafters of a roof. They hold, the whole roof is integrated and held together by seven factors all at once, sustained. Mindfulness is the factor that, again, that keeps the active, energetic, side of the thing balanced with the resultant side. So it keeps checking over. That concentration doesn't lapse and descend into a kind of a blank state. It keeps infusing with energy. And it keeps watching over that the energetic, rapturous side doesn't go off the scale into mere agitation where you can't focus and concentrate anymore. You can't get it down. There's a kind of a too much energy flowing in the body and the mind, and cannot channel it into the focus. So that's the first factor. Becomes into the middle of the teeter-totter, and then you have three on one side, three on the other. The three on one side, on the left side, are investigation, energy, joy, and mindfulness is adjusting on the teeter-totter for serenity, concentration, and equanimity. So that it begins to play in the middle of this. These are the seven factors of enlightenment. And it's when they're brought to development and balanced, it is at that point that such a thing as enlightenment can occur. One may wonder, well, why does one person get enlightened? Do you just think about it or something? Or what happens? Well, how does the light go on? How do you click through? It is not a moment of grace. It doesn't descend out of nowhere on you. And it's not causeless. I mean, the whole teaching of the Buddha is that there are causes and conditions that produce this situation. It's not mystical, mysterious, absent of causes coming from outside. You just come from an arrangement, a psychological arrangement of the mind. When we know this, we don't try to, just futilely try to jump in, without any skill. Or we understand there is some factors to be arranged here. And we take our time and get interested in the arrangement of these internal factors so that they culminate and are balanced. We realize nothing can appear. We can't break through till we get these things arranged properly, balanced properly. That's where our attention goes. We're involved in the preliminaries. There's no point in trying to make the jump before these things are arranged. It's like trying to get over a wall that's 12 feet high. You got to arrange some steps, boxes, springboards, and so forth. And there's just no point in just jumping against that wall. It's futile. You saw somebody goes over the wall. And if you don't have any idea how this could be done, it's just a futile to try and wish that that can happen. It's done. There's a few arrangements that have to be made ahead of time and carefully done. And when you get those arrangements done, then you go over as well. So it's well worth just reflecting on that, just picking up the suggested energy, just even of the talk, while you're listening to the seven factors of enlightenment. If you're listening in the right way, it can produce both tranquility and energy. Yeah, it's suggestive of this. If you have some experience of these factors having come up, and from time to time even been in balance, or even a few of them having come up, you will resonate in a sense. You will be happy to hear of this experience. Even to remember the experience is very inspiring and delightful. One of the most commonly chanted suttas by monks is the seven factors of enlightenment. We chant this because it is for monks. And for anybody who's a meditator who has had a taste of any of these factors of enlightenment, the mere recollection of it, the mere appreciation of the idea of the seven factors is a very can restore one to health. So the chanting of this seven factors of enlightenment sutta is There's a little story in the sutta. It lists off the seven factors of enlightenment. It says that one time the Buddha was physically ill, and he asked a monk to chant, just recite the seven factors of enlightenment for him. Just, they have Pali names, but, you know, mindfulness, investigation of Dhamma, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. If one appreciates these seven jewels, it can be enough, the mind can rejoice in it enough, the truth content of this, that illness is overcome. So the Buddha got over that illness. And also it lists that Kashyapa, one of the chief disciples, also was restored, and Moggallana, another chief disciple. These are arahants who had such an incredible appreciation of these seven factors, recognized them as the seven elements that came together at the moment of enlightenment that liberated them from their suffering. But just to hear them, it's like a medicine for the mind, medicine for the body. So they were. So to this day, we chant these. For illness, seven factors of enlightenment are chanted. By the power of this truth, may you be well. This is one approach to, by the way, if you're interested in an approach to healing the body, one of the most powerful medicines is simply something that resonates with you as true. The truth itself has a lot of power to produce joy, and is a very healing experience if the mind can internalize it. Of course, the way we chant it these days, we do it in Pali, half the people don't understand what we're saying, but if they got a lot of confidence, they think it must be good. But actually, it's more important to know, just to recite this. When I think of the seven factors of enlightenment, it gives me lightness of being and joy and so forth. So this is kind of like a little secondary point to do with well-being, is that the key to induction of positive health and positive states of mind is to reflect on something that you know and feel to be true, deeply has the power of truth. And this is has a lot of curative ability to it. Dispels the darkness of the mind and can literally dispel physical symptoms. So one of the kind of stories of the Buddha's birth, and this is not in the suttas, but this is kind of a mythological story surrounding it, is that when he was born, you know, he was born very developed. He got up and walked right away. You don't have to believe this, but but he took seven steps, and each step behind him sprung up a lotus. And these little baby steps, you know, stood up, took seven steps, and at each step the lotus sprung up. Now what is this? This is the pre-symbolic explanation that who he will become, that he will, by the seven factors of enlightenment, attain Buddhahood. Each of those steps, you can imagine, is just the lotus will spring up under your feet, supported by the lotus. Each one of these factors is a gem and supports you in your steps, in your journey toward enlightenment. Each factor must unfold like a lotus. And you know how the lotus unfolds. It just takes one shaft of sunlight. As soon as the sunlight hits the lotus, it opens. It's the most amazing process. You can see this. It's just fantastic. And all of these petals and petals and petals inside. One layer, it starts with the outer layer, of course. It doesn't all open like at once. There's layers and layers and layers and layers all the way down to the middle, the final petals, and then the final petal open, there's nothing in there. It's completely open, empty in the center. And this happens when all it takes is one streak of sunlight. The first shaft of morning sunlight hits the lotus, and the outer ones open. And then, because they're open, the sunlight hits the next layer, and then that opens, and then the next layer, and that opens, and opens, and opens, and opens. And so this is why the lotus is such an important symbol in the Buddhist teachings of the opening of the mind. As soon as the light hits the mind, the sun, you know, the light of truth hits the mind, then the outer layer opens. And then the next layer, and the next layer. One thing leads to another until it's completely open, and there's nothing in the center. Anatta, no self, the manufacture of the self has ceased. And the cause of all of the problems, the manufacture of the self, it's just a manufactured construct. That ceases, work is done. So there's much more to be said on each of these factors, how to rouse them. I mean, we have spoken, of course, how to practice mindfulness, etc. And there are various tips for assisting the arising of energy, etc., which we left for further talks. So I leave that today for your reflection on the seven factors of enlightenment. Be enough to take us to midnight, I'm not sure. But if you weren't here earlier in the day, maybe some people came for the talk. We'll be offering the opportunity to sit a little later tonight, just celebrating the purchase of the new monastery. sure there's much more to be said on each of these factors, how to rouse them. I mean, we have spoken, of course, how to practice mindfulness, etc. And there are various tips for assisting the arising of energy, etc., which will be left for the talks. So I leave that today for your reflection on the seven factors of enlightenment. Time. Well, there might be enough to take us to midnight, I'm not sure. But if you weren't here earlier in the day, maybe some people came for the talk. We'll be offering the opportunity to sit a little later tonight, just celebrating the purchase of the new monastery, which went through today. And so what else do monks do to celebrate? They sit till midnight, you know. When they're not celebrating, they sit till 11. And when they're celebrating, they sit till midnight. So, yes. You're welcome to join. Anybody who feels they've got a little energy left over and their knees are not sore enough. Also, during these questions, feel free to ask supplemental questions as well. Bhantisona, I know I am not this body, as it would die sooner or later. I am not the breath, as it comes and goes as it pleases. I am not the same as the mind, as I, underlined, am in process of controlling it. I am in the process of controlling it. Who is this I, anyway? Is it perishable as any other thing? If yes, then what is that of this present, or say of this me, that carries the burden of karmas from birth to birth to birth? Right. Just letting go of the idea of an unchanging entity. That's all. We just want to get back to the idea that this is a process from moment to moment. Karma gets carried moment to moment. It's not the same karma. Each moment influences and change and so forth. It's just one process bumps into the next process, bumps into the next process. This is just causality. This is ordinary examination of materiality. This looks like an object, right? Now, if you carry that across the room and put it on the other side, on the conventional level, it's the same cup, isn't it? It moved in space from here over to here, and it moved in time. 1 second before it was there, and now it's here. And we say the conventional notion is that the same cup moved over here. But actually, you know, if you really look at this process deeply, not the same cup. It's a process in time and space, all kinds of momentary processes moving from one point to the other in space, and momentary processes moving in time from one moment to the next. But it's not the same object, not the self, same identical object at two points. At the the fact that it's sustaining the shape, you know, it's good enough to fool your eye, but not good enough to fool an electron microscope, is it? At one level, if you look at a waterfall from the distance, it looks like a solid object, unchanging solid object. But as you come closer, it begins to dissolve. That sense of static quality begins to dissolve, and you look as you come closer, oh, it turns out it's a river falling off a cliff. As you come closer, and if you've been at the bottom of these large waterfalls, the higher the waterfall, sometimes the actual water doesn't even hit the bottom. It's just mist. You find nothing hitting the bottom. But from the distance, it appears as a solid object. From the middle distance, it appears as a flow. And then As you get closer, it appears as droplets, not even a continuous flow. It's a bunch of droplets, and each of those droplets is breaking up also in the flow. But a pattern in the river as it's swirling along, maybe a rock is in the river, and you see a swirl, a whirlpool in the river, and then it comes to the edge and falls over. And that pattern, according to other, you know, impediments, the air pressure and everything, is also its causes and conditions. There's nothing chaotic or non-causal involved in the process. When I use the word chaos, I mean not in this mathematical sense of chaos, of infinite complexity, but something that has no causality at all. Some people have the notion that there's no, you know. In the physical level, we see the causality. Just one condition bumps into the next set of conditions. And what goes between two conditions? Nothing. One set of circumstances, an event arises and conditions the arising of the next event, and the next event, and the next event. And there's no entity going between these two events. They're just rising and setting up the causal matrix for an event. An event flow, okay? A river of events. So your karma, same as, just the same process is found in physics. You don't find a thing in physics. You find events. And the same in the mind. That must be more apparent than any place. That consciousness is not a thing. How could that be? A thing couldn't be responsive, change. How do you know anything? You know in that you're sensitively interacting with an experience or recording an experience. To record an experience means motion, means change. It doesn't mean anything static. If you imagine something to be static, some element of the mind to be static, it would be like a marble, an unchanging monad, which surface can't be inscribed with anything. It wouldn't record any information. It wouldn't be consciousness. Consciousness is the act of receiving information. So therefore, it's not anything like that, a solid notion, what goes from time to time. So when the person is asking about the eye, what's the, you know, the eye doesn't die. Still got the notion that there's an eye outside of the body and outside of the mind. We're not saying that. And we're not saying that the eye perishes at the death of the body, or at the ending of that stream of consciousness. What we're saying is that the notion of the eye is a false problem, as a solid entity. What you have is a process. The body is a process, a river of events. The mind is a process, a river of events. Your feelings are a process, a river of events. And this river just continues on. It doesn't suddenly stop and terminate without any. This series of causes and effects continue. Sometimes the body and the mind deviate and go off into different streams. Consciousness picks up another body. But it's not, when you talk about consciousness, it's not a solid entity of me. Even in one life, even in 2 minutes, there's no you in it. It's a causal series of change, but very meticulously governed by very precise laws of cause and effect. Is it perishable as any other thing? The eye. Well, let's say that your eye, you know, again, you won't find an eye outside of the things that you can observe, like your feelings and your consciousness and your perceptions. But does it perish? Yes, every second. Yeah, birth and death, every second, every millisecond, birth and death. It's not difficult. What's the problem? But in a sense, birth and death, both illusions as well. Nothing absolutely new is coming into existence, and nothing can absolutely go out of existence. What's apparently new and coming into existence is just the resultant of previous causes, and what's what seems to be going out of existence is just a the cessation of one cause and initiating the beginning of other causes. In a sense, like what happens to my fist when I open my hand? What happens to my hand when I close my fist? Is there a birth of a hand and the death of a fist? And is there the death of a hand and the birth of a fist? Yeah, in a sense, there is. Definitely there's a fist. And now it's let it go. Did a little bit of magic here. This is your basic monk's magic. It's everybody else works with a coin or something like that. I just work straight with the hands. Fist, hand. Birth, death. Death, birth. Really all illusion, isn't it? What's happening is just an overlay of concept. There isn't really a fist. There is a process, you know, a changing process. Sometimes we call it a fist. That's just language. That's the crude description of reality using these convenient things called nouns. This convenient matter of convenience. Don't take them seriously. Just begin to look at reality without this translating it through concepts. Just look at it straight and notice that it's all flow. A flow in time, even a apparently solid structure like this, is flowing in time. If you have a camera on it, hold it on it for 100 years or so, you'll see this thing rise and pass away, just like a cloud. It just appears to be solid. Okay. Change the subject a little bit here. Must one be a monk, that is celibate in brackets with a question mark, in order to become enlightened? Must one be a celibate monk in order to become enlightened? Or could one have a partner and or children and or a career and or be active in the community and still achieve enlightenment? Yes. You don't have to be a monk and celibate with a question mark in order to become enlightened. depending on what stage of enlightenment you're talking about, and in order to become enlightened, even to attain arahantship, you do not need to be a monk or celibate. For some people it happens, the stages, you don't necessarily go like you're a stream enterer for 6 months and then you're a once-returner for 6 months and then, a non-returner for 6 months and then you're an arahant. It can happen all in the snap of a finger, right directly from unenlightened to arahant. Theoretically, you've clicked through four path moments like that and attained it. So you see all kinds of, depending on your potential, the background causality that's been already developed through this life and previous lives, there's a potential way in there. almost like understanding mathematics, some people grasp the whole thing completely on being told a principle. Think. Others grasp part of the principle. Others don't grasp it, like me. One full grasp the whole principle, part of the principles, some understand all the implications of it, etc., in terms of mathematics. And this is the same in terms of spiritual practice. Some hit the third stage, just like that. Some full enlightenment. Now, and they may be, like the Buddha's father was a king. And he remained in the palace and everything after the Bodhisattva had left and attained Buddhahood and so forth. He did come back from time to time and influenced his father. His father began to meditate and practice, but he remained in the kingdom and actually attained arahantship within a short time before he died, within a day or two before he died, living in the household life. He had enormous potential. But it wasn't an accident that he happened to be the Buddha's father. You know, the family relationships and so forth are not accidental. You're enmeshed in all kinds of interesting connections. So definitely possible. At the time of the Buddha, many, many thousands of people attained Sotapanna, the first stage of enlightenment. And then the Buddha talked about, thousands of lay people attaining second stage of enlightenment. And then it's also not totally infrequent that they attain the third stage. And now at the third stage, anagami, non-returner, automatic celibacy, all the drives towards the sensual world, the interest in the matter has ceased. Automatic, not from restraint. You're not taking precepts and restraining yourself. The interest is completely vanished from the mind. Possibility has vanished. At that stage, one might remain in the household. There's very tenuous connections. The only kind of connection, you know, the person might be looking after aged parents or something like that who can't look after themselves or something. And they tend to stay around, look after them, but they have no interest in, very little in interest in the world. Their livelihood would just be enough to sustain them, not much interest in anything. And the spiritual development is very high. They're not actually interested in living the householder's life. Just a few karmic obligations. But at arahantship, if you attain arahantship, you cannot continue in the household life. End of possibilities for continuing that. You go forth into the robes within a few days. You enter into the spiritual life. Nothing holds you back. There's nothing in the world for you. Your attachments are all severed. You're at perfect peace. There's no. Your work is finished. Sotapannas can stay. They end up, you know, continuing to function in the family. They have children. They go to work. They make a livelihood. They're involved in things. They still have emotions. They can have unwholesome emotions like anger and greed, just not to the extent that it would manifest in transgressions of precepts like killing somebody or killing an animal out of greed or anger, or stealing something out of greed, or sexual misconduct, just the temptations or something. The person would be quite well, very well contained, but would still be subject to some emotional responses if they were provoked and so forth. They would still have anger and so forth. So, yes, so, in other words, could one have a partner, children, career, and be active in the community and still achieve enlightenment? Yes. You realize, though, these are extra impediments to it. It's not easy. If the person doesn't have a lot of development behind them, these things would tend to interfere with their practice. It's just a matter of time, having the time to sit and practice, and interference and the demands of the work, having to keep it planning and occupying the mind with these things. Difficult. These are extra burdens. That's why the Buddha designed the monastic life. He's saying, what I'll give you is an optimal lifestyle for the attainment of enlightenment and also for the living of enlightenment. This is the natural lifestyle of an arahant. The monastic lifestyle is the natural lifestyle that an arahant would follow, independent of any kind of rules. It would simply be celibate, uninterested in material aspect of reality, meditative, not out there, still compassionate, able to teach, to instruct others, but so that's an optimal lifestyle for the attainment of it and for the sustaining of it, to live in that lifestyle. The householder's life has a whole range, all the way from just a nightmare, a complete impediment to the whole thing, all the way to fairly conducive. You know, you happen to be surrounded by people who support your practice, and you don't have to, your work is easy and not entangling. Doesn't mean that your job is interesting. Interesting might be an impediment to your practice, that you're very, very interested and involved in your work. It's better to have something that you don't really care very much about. You do it, but you don't care particularly about it. You do it, it's not that you're incompetent at it, or you do it in a shoddy way. It's best not to really care one way or the other, be very attached to it. There's an impediment you're attached, deeply attached. So sometimes what seems to be an enviable position where you're involved, the arts or maybe some very interesting science kind of so forth, it seems to be a wonderful thing. But in terms of the spiritual life, the other side of the coin is that it's sometimes better. So you hear many stories about people who are quite talented and intelligent and everything, but choose not to. They their maintenance man at, or a janitor or a clerk in a store doesn't have to involve much in the way of investment of intellect and energy into that livelihood. They prefer to have a simple livelihood where they can just keep their practice going. If you have any, if there's anything that I left out, by all means, you can inquire. Dear Bhikkhu Sona, Jack Kornfield and Thich Nhat Hanh have both expressed the view that some people need psychotherapy before they can benefit from the teachings of the Dhamma, i.e., that they need to have a certain sense of self before they can work with non-self. Do you agree with this view, and have you had the experience that skillful teaching of the Dhamma makes it accessible to everyone without the prerequisite of psychotherapy? Well, this is a very interesting area. There's been a lot of talk back and forth about this. Jack's kind of biased because he is a therapist, I think. Thich Nhat Hanh is not too biased. I mean, he's a monk. He's not a psychotherapist. I think certainly, psychotherapy may not be outside of Dhamma. Why are you talking about two different things here? Skillfully dealing with another person in a compassionate way, intelligent way, understanding their motivations, perhaps a lot better than they understand their own motivations, is not outside of Dhamma. Common sense is not, there's not Dhamma and then there's common sense. Common sense is very much a part of the teaching of the Buddha. You see it very clearly in the arrangement of the Vinaya, how the monks behave. He tells them you have to brush your teeth, and after the meal, you have to wash your bowl, and you have to, clean up, you make sure you get the cobwebs out of your place and sweep, and all of these things. This is housework kind of knowledge, but it's also the Buddha's teaching, straight from the Buddha as well. We don't see them as opposites. The word psychotherapy, what does that mean? There isn't a standard church of psychotherapy that you can sort of, there's all kinds of mind wellness kind of approaches. Some of them I might say, well, that what you're saying there is really not dhammic. And on the other hand, some of them might be very dhammic, very compassionate, and so forth. So you have to say, it's not just psychotherapy in general. What psychotherapy? What are you saying? If the, like the psychotherapist, if the therapist says to the person, you know, but you're lacking in confidence, you know, basically. You know, you're having a problem with your husband. He doesn't find you attractive or anything. What you should do is have an affair. Boost your self-confidence. And this in order to establish yourself before you start meditating. No. I would say that would be contrary to dhammic advice. That would be, you know, the idea that this is inconsequential. It's just a matter of boosting your self-esteem or something like that. That kind of advice would be plainly contradictory. You should get some exercise. Maybe go deer hunting. Get out, do more, you know, hunting and fishing, trapping. You need to develop a macho kind of appreciation of things. This again, the Buddha couldn't agree with this advice. No matter what the person, what this condition is, the Buddha said, no, don't give them that advice. They don't need to develop a self that badly. You know, they can do it other ways, some other skillful way. So some of them may be all right. So certain people need psychotherapy before they can benefit from the teachings of Dhamma. Again, you might be talking about very sophisticated level of Dhamma, like coming to a retreat like this, where you're having to, you know, a substantial level of patience and the focusing of the mind and the ability to be, you know, behave yourself and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, if a person is not in control of the faculties at all, it might be, I wouldn't recommend them to come so-called meditation retreat. Now, a person, some people ask, could meditation be dangerous for a person who's imbalanced or something like that? Well, no, meditation isn't dangerous for them. They don't meditate. When they come to a retreat and sit down and close their eyes, that is not meditation, sitting down with your eyes closed. If you sit down and with your eyes closed and hallucinate, it could be bad for you. You know, that's not meditation. So obviously we wouldn't say that meditation is not bad for you. Meditation implies that you actually have some aspect of control, wholesome control of the mind. But people whose mind is out of control, they don't meditate when they close their eyes. They fall into the soup of their own mind. And it may be not recommended. Maybe usually what would happen at a monastery, and these people in Buddhist countries have mental problems too. And often one of the places they go is the monastery. Because the monastery is all over the place. Lots of monks. Big interaction with society, and often a person who's troubled goes to the monastery, yeah, but talks to them, so forth, evaluates them. It doesn't take long to spot a person that's having these problems, and they usually give them some sort of workaround, you know, help with the cooking or some sweeping. Sometimes they like to chant. That would be part of the sense of the community, chant, but usually they don't have them. They never suggest too much that they sit down with their eyes closed and try to sustain a long meditation retreat or anything. They would be keeping more in touch with reality, eyes open, doing things, trying to give them reflections about their behavior, whether it's appropriate or not, about their speech. Talk to them in a very direct way on the level of the person. In a very individual way. So that could be called psychotherapy. Maybe psychotherapy is not a recent invention. Maybe a wise person always was practicing psychotherapy. Is the Buddha practicing psychotherapy? He's dealing with all kinds of levels of people. He doesn't all say, oh, you come and be a monk and sit down here and meditate. Not everybody. He has a different advice for all kinds of people in different states. Sometimes, though, the spiritual... Well, the word spiritual is not even a good... You know, a wise person who has understood their mind very deeply can be very, very helpful to a person who needs so-called psychotherapy. Yeah. And, of course, the Buddha is not against building up a sense of self-worth and being giving a sense of, making endeavor in the world. He has a teaching, a relative teaching for lay people in the household life who are maybe not aspiring to Nibbana in this life or not aspiring even to meditation. He's very much about giving them very clear guidelines about... You know, you got to get up in the morning and go to work and save your money and don't spend it all and don't wander around at night, don't drink, and try to develop good relationships with your wife and your children and your relatives, and you have to be generous to people and patient and kind and understanding. These are all advice, just normal, functional, ego development advice. A very nice description of that advice to the householder is a sutta called the Sigalaka Sutta, advice to Sigalaka. And it's just about managing your life in a sensible way of managing your life, how your relationship to your parents, to your children, to your employers, to your employees, the attitude towards work, the attitude towards money, investing, who to pal around with and who not to, you know, who are your friends and who are not, how not to waste your money and your time, how to use it profitably. These are all basic instructions of the Buddha to householders, without any mention particularly of meditation, and it would say a relationship also to monks and spiritual people. Dear Bhikkhusona, while doing walking meditation after lunch today, I had a kestrel fly within a few feet of me. Kestrel is a hawk, one of those little, small hawk that flies very, very fast. I think they catch mosquitoes. I frequently have experiences during or just after retreats of birds coming very close to me. Do we generate some kind of energy, or is it the stillness that attracts them? Yeah, well, that kind of stuff is just the weird stuff that happens, you know. Just watch it. It's hard. You really can't say all that much about it other than that you really have to notice it. There are strange things. Just open your mind to all kinds of interesting possibilities. And when you go to retreats, you're changing a lot of different energies. And synchronistic, symbolic, meaningful, strange events happen. And we don't want to just, shut down our mind about this. Just be open to these things and watch it. And sometimes it's better not to explain it, just feel it. Yeah. The bird is just your totem animal. You are related to the birds. Whatever it feels like, that's a good enough explanation. Ante, thank you for letting us offer Dana for you today with all of the merits I acquired. May you be well, happy, and peaceful, and finally attain supreme bliss of Nibbana. Thank you very much. That's a couple of the ladies did the offering of the meal today. Of course, traditional part of life in Asia is make regular visits to the monastery, or when the monks go by on alms round, to help feed them. And so it's an integral part of the monastic life. Again, you know, I can't cook for myself or just go and help myself to food. So every day for every monk the meal has to be received from a layperson offering it to you. And this is set up very deliberately by the Buddha, and it's a meritorious action on the part of the layperson. A lot of positive energy is developed from this dana, offering the meal. And as I gave the reflection today, four things return to one who gives food: long life, strength, beauty, happiness. That is what food, of course, supports. If I don't get food, I don't have a very long life. If I don't get food, I'm not very strong. If I don't get food, I don't look too good. And if I don't get food, I'm not all that happy either. So if I get food, it supports longevity, strength, beauty of a sort. And but as beautiful as you can be. Happiness. Everybody feels a little happier after a bit of a meal, right? You are giving this, and hopefully when one does give food, one thinks, this is what I'm giving this person. And even, you know, there's nothing more fun than feeding a cat or a dog, is there? It's enjoyable, you know. Feeding them, so forth, enjoying they like that. You can just see that very meaningful event to them. We have a cat at the monastery which showed up, and it was wild, and I sort of a cast off thing slinking around in the bush, and one of the meditators eventually tamed it and made friends, and it slowly got accustomed to humans, and now it's just a thing that lies around and purrs all day and is fed. And but it shows very great its gratitude when I feed it. Even though it's hungry, you put the food into the dish, it won't eat it before it comes over and rubs against your leg. Like, first thing is show gratitude. It does its thank you, you know, and then goes to the food. Even no matter how hungry, it always, you know, acknowledges your presence, goes, nudges in a bit, and then goes to the food. It's a very interesting interaction. So this is a very, you know, a beautiful recognition that the Buddha, you know, has a little, I think it's a teaching for children. One of the teachings for children is, what's the one thing? What's the one thing all beings need? And the answer is food. In the whole universe, any animate being needs food. No matter what level they are, everything needs this intake of energy. Nothing lives without this. That is one thing we have in common with every being, big, small, near, far, in the whole universe. We all need food. So that act of sharing is profound. There's a profound energy and repercussion built into that around the offering of food. So it's a very beautiful experience. It's also very beautiful to be on the receiving end of it. not easy, especially for Western monks, because we have this everybody likes to be the giver, you know, to be the generous person. But can you receive? That's the hard part. Can you? How do you receive gifts? To be an object of charity is an interesting switch in life. You're not allowed to, you know, before you're independent. We're all seeking to be independent. Now you're not allowed to. Buddha cuts off any possibility of the monks being independent. You can't farm, you can't grow anything. You can't even pick an apple off a tree. Can't live, you have to receive your alms every day. It makes you completely dependent on the lay people. So it's a very nice change of position, and it's just very beautiful to go on alms. I never got over that, just walking through the village. People come out, don't know you from anybody. You're a complete stranger. You walk right up, feed you. And there's no, you don't ask for it or anything like that. And there's just, at most, there's a little blessing, you know. A long life, strength, beauty, happiness. And they're delighted to do it. And it's a great moment, a beautiful transaction. It's too bad we don't have this available to us. Just, the first thing on your way to work, somebody just give them some food. Well, people do that with their cats and the birds, and they love to go out and feed the birds and do this. It's a very charming part of life, isn't it? But you don't have the strings of monks walking through the around it in the morning to put some food in the bowl. Tremendous merit comes back. Tremendous karmic result. You know, aside from the emotion of the time, there's enormous repercussions of generosity karmically. Dear Bhante, concerning one overwhelmingly good act resulting in a person going to a heavenly realm, even though they may not have led a, quote, good life, does the opposite also true? i.e., if as a child someone wished a parent dead, does the bad karma from this unskillful behavior relegate them to a lower realm? I don't suppose karma looks at extenuating circumstances, she said hopefully. Well, I think that's a fairly natural kind of emotional thought. You know, kids get angry and so forth. That's one of the great guilt things. You know, you wish your parent was dead and so forth. There are, again, the mitigating circumstances that one is a child, and the emotional the clarity and understanding of your behavior is different. The karma never makes a mistake. It's intrinsic to the action. The intention is intrinsic to the action. If you didn't understand what you're doing as a child, if you pull your mother's favorite vase off the table and smash it as a kid, you have no clear intention there. You don't know what you're doing. It's not a direct karmic result. But if you do know what you're doing, understand what you're doing, then there's a karmic result. It's possible that a significant negative action would be the dominant influencing event at the time of death, even if one had led, generally speaking, a fairly wholesome life. But if there's one dominant thought, the Buddha says this happens in both directions. So what one should do is try to do as much counterbalancing kind of karma, to make as much white karma as you can. Every opportunity, just the dominant effect will be your habitual, regularly done actions. unless there's one very outstanding heavy karma in one, in the direction of goodness or in the other direction. You know, if you'd given, say, one meal to a living Buddha, it would be an enormous kind of repercussion. Just enough, that would be enough to put you over the top. Or if you'd done one, you know, really negative deed that sticks with you your whole life, and you haven't done any counterbalancing, reconditioning, to influence yourself in the other way, it could have a result. So certainly, in either case, whether you have done good, the doing of good is accompanied by pleasure and joy and happiness and has good results. So if you have done bad things in the past, then one should do good. If one has done good things in the past, then one should do good. Very simple thing. The past is gone. Whatever is done is done. One advice is, do not think about it, especially negative things. Don't bring it up. Do not dwell in guilt, unwholesome